apart from any of seven of those.
Depends on any definition.
Not as much as I should.
Should according to what criteria?
Yeah.
Be well-informed citizen of the 21st century?
Well, you know, it's funny because I know a lot of well-informed citizens that don't know much about science. They seem to be doing pretty well. So I talk about this stuff because I feel compelled to do.
We're good to go.
Ready to go?
Yes. If everybody would be willing to introduce themselves, and is everybody okay with being recorded for a podcast? Yes? Okay, cool. Do I have to start? I'm Willow. I put these together. Thank goodness the last time and this time, other people have decided that they're willing and able to talk about things that they're really passionate about, so that's been awesome. And go!
Cameron, and I got nothing else right now.
That's cool.
I'm Morgan.
I'm Sid.
I'm Colleen.
I'm Rob.
I'm Josh.
I'm Andre.
And I'm Ben.
Awesome. And Joshua is giving our presentation today.
Are you on chat with
yes.
People? Can they hear me okay? Is this a good volume?
Gentlemen? Still fine. Okay, awesome.
Get louder. All right. So like I said, I'm going to read a lot of this because otherwise I will tend to digress into a lot of tangents and not be able to get all of this in. And I may go just a little bit over the hour. If somebody can stop me or give me a heads up as we're approaching 9 p.m., that would be great.
Or 8 p.m.
Instead of now 8 p.m., thanks.
Okay.
Working multiple time zones. All right, so what do you think of when you think of cybernetics? You might think of electronically enhanced organisms or robots or artificial intelligence or virtual reality. All of these things derive at least in part from cybernetics, but none of them encapsulates what cybernetics really is. Perhaps you've never heard the word before. And no, it does not mean freezing dead people. That's probably dead. Is anybody in the wrong room now? Although Plato used the Greek word kybernetes, which means steersman, refers to the person who steers a ship, to refer to governors, it wasn't until 1948 that mathematician Norbert Wiener transformed it into cybernetics. The silence of teleological mechanisms, or the study of control and communication in the animal and the machine. Control and communication, because they're kind of two sides of the same coin, and the animal and the machine, because of the universal nature of control and communication. A quick note about systems in cybernetics. Systems theory developed about the same time as cybernetics, and it's unique perspective what distinguishes it from biology and psychology and anthropology, etc., and other sciences, is that it looks at interactions between systems. For example, people and the environment. And it tends to be holistic in its approach. Some people think that cybernetics is a subdiscipline of systems theory. Some people think systems theory is a subset of cybernetics. I just want you all to know that the two are often found together. Okay? So, I'm going to start off with this quote. This is by Philip K. Dick. And he says, our environment, and I mean our man-made world of machines, artificial constructs, computers, electronic systems, interlinking homeostatic components, all this is in fact beginning more and more to possess what the earnest psychologist fears the primitive sees in his environment, animation. In a very real sense, our environment is becoming alive, or at least quasi-alive, in a way specifically and fundamentally analogous to ourselves. And I emphasized the bit there, our environment is becoming alive in ways specifically and fundamentally analogous to ourselves, because that's a very cybernetic idea, and that's something that I'm going to spend a lot of emphasis on this evening. Those my gratuitous cyborg and cyberspace images from the show.
Hello.
We're just getting started. This is pictures of a bunch of cyber magicians. Most of them are now dead. I think Macharana and Mike and Margaret Mead, maybe the only living ones. I had a whole bunch of stuff I was going to do about the history of cybernetics. I'm actually going to save that, skip over that, and do it at the end, if we have time. Because the last time I gave a presentation like this, I spent so much time talking about the history of cybernetics, I completely ran out of time to talk about some of the key ideas. Because there's a lot there to talk about. Really cool people, really cool stuff happened. Just to give you just a little bit, this says a brief and biased history of cybernetics. Cybernetics was huge in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, particularly the 50s and 60s. And there were several different cybernetics movements going on. My lineage, so to speak, is a member of the American Society for Cybernetics. And stuff going back to the Heinz von Forster's Biological Computer Lab in Illinois, and stuff coming out of the Mason conferences on cybernetics. But there's all kinds of stuff that happened in like Russian cybernetics, and a lot of stuff that I'm not going to talk about here. I'm going to talk about cybernetics as I've learned it, which is kind of a cybernetic idea. And I'm going to start by mentioning information theory. This is Claude Shannon's, sort of my depiction of Claude Shannon's model of information theory, which he published in 1948 in Mathematical Theory of Communication. And Norbert Wiener, who wrote the book Cybernetics, developed a similar theory of information, kind of pretty much independently, although they do have some communication between each other. Around the same time, and this this model of communication has had a lot of influence on what we know today as computer technology and information technology. Shannon was able to develop a quantitative model of information, which is related to basically what it means to gain or lose information. And there's some isomorphism between his measurement of information as the as the inverse of entropy, which he calls negentropy, and statistical entropy. And the only thing I really want you to get out of this is that there was a lot of influence on cybernetics on the idea of the transmission and reception of signals and information, and that information has something to do, measuring information has something to do with the uncertainty of information going over a channel. This model is actually missing something that is a key component in making it a cybernetic model, and that's feedback. Feedback is not just noise from electronic speakers placed too closely to one another. Feedback occurs any time the output of a process is fed back to the input of the same process. Notice the circularity there. Heinz von Forster said, should one name one central concept, a first principle of cybernetics, it would be circularity. Circularity as it appears in the circular flow of signals in organizationally closed systems, or in circular causality, that is, in processes in which ultimately a state reproduces itself. Now, Wiener subtitled his book Control on Communication in the Animal and Machine, and he explains, when I give an order to a machine, the situation is not essentially different from that which arises when I give an order to a person. In other words, as far as my consciousness goes, I am aware of the order that has gone out and of the signal of compliance that has come back. To me personally, the fact that the signal is in its intermediate stages has gone through a machine rather than a person is irrelevant and does not in any case greatly change my relation to the signal. Thus, the theory of control engineering, whether human or animal or mechanical, is a chapter in the theory of messages. Okay. So, when I manipulate a machine's input device, such as a keyboard, I'm monitoring for evidence of my efficacy. On some level, I'm looking for a signal that the key that I pressed registered somewhere. And that creates a loop, okay, between me and the machine that I'm interfacing with. And it also establishes a level of goal accomplishment, which takes us into composite systems. Most of the stuff I'm going to be talking about today can be called purposive activity. And usually the most common example of a purposive system is a living organism, right? A dog doesn't just walk randomly around. It's going somewhere to get shelter, it's going somewhere to eat, something like that. There's another quote from Wiener that I want to add in here. He said that, here I want to interject the semantic point that words such as life, purpose, and soul are grossly inadequate to precise scientific thinking. Now that certain analogies of behavior are being observed between the machine and the living organism, the problem as to whether the machine is alive or not is, for our purposes, semantic, and we are at liberty to answer it one way or another as best suits our convenience. And the point there is that artificiality is arbitrary. Greg Bateson in Steps in Ecology of Mind asks, where does a blind man end? Is a blind man's walking stick a part of him? Does the blind man end 3 inches down the stick? Does it end at the end of the stick? These are kind of absurd answers. The reality is that the meaning of the stick is related to the process, man-stick-road. So we have that circularity again. The drawings down at the bottom here are circular and depict organisms coupled with their environments and each other. The circles are the organisms, no squiggly lines to the environment. These are drawings by Humberto Maturana, who, along with Francisco Varela, developed the theory of autopoiesis, or self-creation, to describe systems whose actions conserve their unity or their identity through the many state changes they undergo in relation to their environment. Perturbations, it's when you disturb a system, you're perturbing it, doing something to it, leading to destructive state changes, do not conserve autopoiesis and basically result in the death of the organism. Maturana's systems are structurally coupled to their environment. Perturbations generate responses, which generate perturbations, etc., etc. So organisms and environments evolve together. You might say they evolve dialogically. And they are also structurally determined. A bullet is a destructive perturbation to a human being, but only a perturbation to a werewolf. Unless it's silver, which is actually a bad example, because that's a symbolic perturbation, really, more than a structural one. But I had the pleasure of meeting Craig Venture at the town hall last year, and he's done a lot of work with it. Human genome project, discovering mapping the genomes. And he said that one of his projects has been to figure out what are the basic, most fundamental constituents of a living organism. Like, what's the most simple thing you can build and call it alive? And what they discovered was you can't specify the components of that thing, whatever it is, without also specifying variables in its environment. So a cell literally cannot exist in isolation. Now, the word cyborg first appeared in Manfred Klein and Nathan Klein's 1960 paper, Cyborgs in Space. And it described human-machine hybrid systems that could survive the hazardous environments of space travel. Here we have a human whose coupling with the environment of outer space would be destructive if it wasn't for the astronaut suit she's wearing. The suit acts on the interaction between the astronaut and her environment, creating local conditions as if the astronaut was in a comfortable temperature zone with clean air, etc. And the reason for that has to do with records of variety. British psychiatrist William Ross Ashby developed the law of requisite variety, which is one of the most well-known laws of cybernetics. Some would say it's the only law to have come out of cybernetics. And it basically says that to control something, you must have as much variety as the thing you're trying to control. Okay? And Ashby defines variety as the number of possible states of a system. Okay? And changes from one state to another are called state transitions, and much of Ashby's work involved working with state machines and finding correspondences between state machines and living biological and psychological behaviors. Stafford Beer, who's also English, is a managerial cybernetician, extended Ashby's work to managing social groups, corporations, governments, etc. And this is actually Beer's illustration. And he's showing here that to compensate for greater variety in the managed system, so for example, in the environment, if you're an organism trying to survive, you need to find ways to either amplify your own variety or attenuate the variety that's in the environment or the system that you're trying to regulate. As a side note, it's worth noting that Ashby's formal treatment of the law of requisite variety corresponds to Shannon's information theory model. How are we doing so far? Too fast, too slow, or?
You're doing a fantastic job.
Yeah.
You didn't look so certain.
No, just a lot of terms and concepts that I haven't really been exposed to, so I'm just going to be kind of mulling them over as you're talking.
Is that common? Like, is there a lot of, am I dropping a lot of terminology, like jargon bombs here that people are like?
If you did not have the diagrams, I would be going crazy. You have the diagrams, things are amazing.
Cool. All right. So, I'm not big on bullet points, but I love diagrams. Here we see three examples of implementing the principles from the previous slide. I've corresponded them to Tim Leary's SMILE agenda, space migration, intelligence increase, and life extension, which are kind of transhumanist ideas. In the first image, we see the control panel for a space shuttle. The panel integrates communication and control in a variety of instruments that give the pilots access to states they could not acquire by themselves, such as information about the environment and actions that they can do, thrusters, for example. So I can't fly into space by myself, but I can get into a vehicle and fly into space. In the second image, we see a human brain, and I'm just going to quote this bit directly from Ashby, because I'm a big fan of quotes, if you know. Because a lot of these guys said this stuff better than I could, so I might as well just put it the way they said it. Ashby said, problem solving is largely, perhaps entirely, a matter of appropriate selection. Take, for instance, any popular book of problems and puzzles. Almost everyone can be reduced to the form, out of a certain set, indicate one element. It is, in fact, difficult to think of a problem, either playful or serious, that does not ultimately require an appropriate selection as necessary and sufficient for its solution. It is also clear that many of the tests used for measuring intelligence are scored essentially according to the candidate's power of appropriate selection. Thus, it is not possible that what is commonly referred to as intellectual power may be equivalent to power of appropriate selection. If this is so, and we know that power of selection can be amplified, it seems to follow that intellectual power, like physical power, can also be amplified. And let no one say that it cannot be done, for the gene patterns do it every time they form a brain that grows to be something better than the gene patterns themselves could have specified. What is new is that we can now do it synthetically, consciously, and deliberately. What he had to say about intelligence increase. And the third image here is really hard to read and see, and sorry about that. It's a drawing of Stafford Beer's viable systems model, which describes social organizations such as business corporations as living organisms struggling to survive in competitive and cooperative environments, which can be used to prescribe management techniques which facilitate the organization's survival. Not a popular business model in 2008, but I'm pushing for it. There's one more quote from Wiener that I want to drop here. And he says, where our word goes, and where our power of perception goes, to that point our control and in a sense our physical existence is extended. To see and give commands to the whole world is almost the same as being everywhere. So, along with the law of requisite variety, Ross Ashby also developed, along with Roger Conant, the Conant-Ashby theorem of a good regulator theorem. Every good regulator of a system must be or contain a model of that system. Now, that might obviously apply to engineers who make conceptual models of systems and apply those models to control said systems, but what might not be so obvious is that the model regulator identity applies to all well-regulated systems, even those that do not include a human operator, i.e. autonomous system. The example shows a thermostat which regulates the temperature in a room by monitoring the temperature and activating the heat source when the temperature falls below a certain threshold and deactivating the heat source when the room is warm enough again. What I want you to notice here is that there are variables or states in the thermostat that map to variables or states in the environment. In a sense, the thermostat knows what to do to keep the room at a consistent temperature. The good regulator theorem corresponds to the law of requisite knowledge, which says that it's not enough to have sufficient variety. You must know, i.e. be able to select the state, which is going to correspond favorably with the state of the environment or system being regulated. If we take the roof off of the room so it's no longer a closed system, or we start a fire or a snowstorm in the room, the state of the room will exceed the range of states, i.e. variety, that the thermostat can handle. It won't know what to do. Note there is no representation here. The thermostat does not need to have a miniature idea of the room and its temperature in mind in order to behave as though it does. Now, when the thermostat breaks or a fire breaks out in the room, the system becomes unstable. And as Richard Dawkins, this is a quote from Dawkins here, The Selfish Gene, he says, Darwin's survival of the fittest is a special case of a more general law called survival of the stable. And as Richard Dawkins points out, stability is all around us. Everything we can point to and identify and give a name to is stable, at least long enough for us to point at and name it. And we are stable long enough to do so. We call Maturana as autopoietic systems that can serve their self-organization. It's a type of stability. A rock is a good example of stability, which is why Jesus and the Three Little Pigs recommend building your house on or with them. Sit a rock down somewhere and it stays there really well. That is until someone comes along and picks it up again. But if you go and try to pick up a cat, it can hiss, meow, scratch, bite, jump, or run away. In other words, the cat can change its state to correspond to changes in the state of its environment. It has more variety than the rock, although it's worth noting that the rock can do a few things that a cat cannot, such as survive being run over by a car. And that goes back to Maturana's notion of structural determinants, which I'll hit on a few more times throughout this. The third system here, again, Norbert Wiener said, in the animal and the machine. The third system here depicts Ashby's homeostat, which is a machine which does what the cat does. It changes its state to compensate for perturbations and so conserves homeostasis. The homeostat has four units, with each connected to the inputs and outputs of the other three, such that when any one of the unit's instruments is perturbed, the others adjust themselves until all four instruments are stable again. If you Google homeostat, somebody did a really cool Java applet that demonstrates one, so you can actually interact with one. And it kind of looks like an EEG machine, and it's not really that exciting. It might be hard to extrapolate from that, like, you know, intelligent robots walking around, but it is a step. So, how do we become ultra-stable systems? The first two images here demonstrate how the sensor and motor systems operate as a closed loop. And I'll talk more about closure in a couple of slides. What we have here, these are Von Forrester's drawings, and what he's trying to show here is that the sensor system connects to the motor system in such a way as you can map it topologically on a torus. So again, it suggests the idea of a closed loop system, self-contained and a self-organized and organizing system. The nervous system computes, or rather compares, differences. Imagine all of the things that are happening around you that you're not aware of because they have receded into ambiance. Then something changes and you may become aware of it. This is different than how a modern computer von Neumann machine computes, which is the kind of computation we typically think of when we think of computers and electronic computation, in the sense of receiving and transmitting information. When light hits your eyes, there is nothing in your eyes which decodes the color of light and tells you this color is red and that color is blue. Yet somehow we become aware of these differences. Von Forrester has a theory of how we go from the simple computations that happen at the surface of the sensor actuator interface or the sensor motor interface to elaborate behaviors in rich complex symbol systems that we use in language. And that's his theory of eigenbehaviors. And eigen is a German or Dutch word that means own, peculiar, and is often in this context translated as proper. It's the same eigen as you find in eigenvector, eigenvalues, and stuff in various systems. I don't want to get too much into that, but the gist of his eigenbehavior theory is that, for example, at some point in my history, I probably ran into a table, and I probably set something on top of or under a table, and I probably moved a table, and I may have broken a table or witnessed one break, and I may have recognized that tables behave, or that tables behave like other objects of similar substance or structure, etc. So I have a history of interactions with something, and comparisons, i.e. computations of those interactions, converge on a stable pattern out of which emerges table as a distinct object or class of objects. This is similar to how attractors work in chaos theory. Why do stable objects emerge? Steven Pinker, in The Language Instinct, points to an evolutionary advantage to identifying and naming objects. It invites prediction, which is feed forward. He says, it's a jungle out there, and the organism designed to make successful predictions about what is going to happen next will leave behind more babies designed just like it. Conceiving of an extent of solid matter as a thing, that is, giving a single mental name to all of its parts, invites the prediction that those parts will continue to occupy some region of space and will move as a unit. And for many portions of the world, that prediction is correct. Look away and the rabbit still exists. Lift the rabbit by the scruff of the neck and the rabbit's feet and the rabbit's ears come off the rock. The key point here is the discovery of the quote-unquote outside world is interactive. And one of the things Ashby said in the introduction to cybernetics is that cybernetics does not treat things, but ways of behaving. It's not interested in what something is, but what does it do? And Maturana wrote a book recently. It's actually a series of interviews. It's called From Being to Doing. And those of you who are familiar with the vernacular prime and stuff, probably kind of familiar with Korzybski's.
I would like to point out that Matt in the chat is a total math nerd and he's really happy right now.
Alright, cool. The third image here shows a network of six neurons. Sorry, it's not highly visible. But the three on the left are receptor neurons, the three on the right are effector neurons. And they're connected by two inhibiting synapses and one dialogue. The broken lines at the bottom are the connectivity required for the neurons to be purposive. Again, the purposive system must be a closed loop. The nested loops visually correspond to metaprogramming and the idea that you can have one loop which determines a behavior, i.e. a stimulus response, and another loop which determines whether that loop gets activated. Warren McCulloch, who developed pretty much our model of synapses and neurons that we use today, along with Walter Pitts, he drew this, and he observes that just six synapses networked this way can produce more variety than we can analyze with a scale of values or a hierarchy. And the neuron's interconnectivity produces a rich heterarchy, is a word he used, of values. And to talk more about that, I'm going to talk about the differences between trivial and non-trivial systems. One thing that just occurred to me, are the people online, how do they know when to, because I'm not giving them cues when I'm changing the...
Right now we just have Matt with us, and he went through the slides earlier make sure he was keeping up. So.
All right. Thanks, Matt. So here we have two models of machines. The one on the left is what von Forster calls a trivial machine. Notice it looks like a function. And the one on the right is what he calls non-trivial. Now, a trivial machine always produces the same output for the same input. You put bread in your toaster, you activate the switch, you get toast. And you get the same toast every time you do it. If you don't, you infer that the machine is broken. Something about it changed. But for the most part, it always produces a consistent output. And it's a trivial machine. It's a trivial mechanism. We understand how it works pretty much completely. A trivial machine is history independent, i.e. it does not adapt or learn. It's analytically determinable, and it is almost entirely predictable. It's the kind of machine that works well in laboratories, textbooks, and kitchens everywhere. A non-trivial machine has an additional function, which we can consider an internal state. F here is the driving function, and the big Z here is the state function. When this non-trivial machine receives an input, it checks to see what state it is in, returns the output for that state, and then computes its next state. It is history dependent, analytically undeterminable, and unpredictable. A machine with just a few connections can have thousands of different possible states. Does anybody here know how many synapses are in the brain?
An obscene amount.
Yeah, lots and lots. And by far, the majority of those are not directly connected to either the sensor or the motor system. So they're computing lots and lots and lots and lots of internal states. Okay. So why do we find so many consistent behaviors? How does order arise from chaos, so to speak? And the answer is, again, feedback and the closure that it creates. The non-trivial system develops stable patterns through its interactions with the environment and other machines. If I walk around randomly, I will likely encounter destructive perturbation. I'll walk into traffic or fall off the edge of the flat earth or whatever. So I learned to walk orderly. I need to return to the same state that was successful in the past by observing others who walk in known hazards and traffic signals. But if you see me walking in a straight line, you can never know when I might deviate from that because you do not have access to my internal states. You have to infer from what you know from what I'm going to do. As a side note, it's worth noting that von Forster's self-organizing systems model again corresponds to Shannon's information model. It's Gordon Pask wrote a paper called Heinz von Forster's Self-Organization, the Progenitor of Conversation and Action Theories, which I'll talk about. Not about the paper, but about his interaction with conversation theories. He goes into how you derive von Forster's self-organization from Claude Shannon's entropy theory and information theory. So here I'm going to talk about closure again. Not to belabor the point, but it's pretty important in understanding all of this, and the idea of coupling. Now, the first image here, for those of you who can't see it, this top group is the environment, and these are constraints and structure, and the bottom group here is structural determination in the brain. And the first image tells us that constraints in the environment generate structure, which affects the structure of the organism that is coupled with the environment, including the brain, which computes and operates on the constraints of the environment. Okay. With that in mind, we move to the second image that shows two subjects, S1 and S2, coupled to their environment, E. Since each subject is a member of the other's environment, the latter are represented here as two different additional environments, E1 and E2. Right? When I look around the room, you guys are in my environment, but I'm not. And when you guys look at me, I'm in your environment. You're probably not in your own. Okay, so we have two different versions of the environment. We represent as E1 and E2. The third diagram shows that through comparisons of their environments, E1 and E2, S1 and S2 may converge on like representations, which they may agree as E, and call it objective. Remember this over the next couple of slides, because this is how cybernetics eludes the trap of solipsism. The fourth image shows how the nervous systems of the two closed organizations are coupled through language. And I don't know if you guys can see this in the back, but what we have here is we have, say, S1 and E1. So we have an eye that's looking at a flower. Okay, so an organism coupled with that. So we have closure there. We have another eye coupled with what may be the same flower, may not be the same flower, there's no way to know. But through language, their nervous systems are coupled, okay, and they converge on a common representation of their environment. So you have one system saying, hey, do you see the flower? And the other system saying, yes, I see the flower. Or the other system might say, no, I don't see the flower.
Yes. Tell me what a solipsism is.
Solipsism is a philosophical notion that everything is just in our heads.
Yes.
I guess it can get a little more complicated than that, but it's pretty philosophically poor, in my opinion, so I don't want to make it more complicated than it is. It kind of stands in an opposite relation to theism, which is a far less popular philosophy, which is the notion that only things exist. So all the like abstract stuff that we talk about all the time, none of that stuff really exists on any kind of level whatsoever. Only things are the only things that really exist. This linguistic coupling is a really important concept. The next couple of slides, we're going to talk more about it. And I want to point out, apropos of technology, in his book, The Electronic Cottage, Joseph Deakin says that computers are an unprecedented medium for language, allowing our words to produce effects both in the medium that carries them and in the world beyond. That's an idea we'll talk about more a little bit here. Joseph also said that cooperative language is the essence of computing, and your own literacy is the key. Umberto Maturana calls language consensual coordination of consensual coordinations of actions, right? So organisms and environments evolve through consensual coordinations. Sometimes there's not consensual coordinations, but language is coordinations of coordinations. Paul Pingaro talks about an idea called through looping, where those feedback loops that produce purposive behavior and regulation of variety and consistent behavior in non-trivial machines are created by our interactions through each other and our technologies. And here on the left, we see a loop based on Gordon Pass' theory of interaction and conversation. Pass developed a number of teaching machines, and on the bottom right is a diagram of the music color machine, which was pretty cool. What it does is it produces the patterns of light in response to music played, but it will get bored and stop responding nicely if the operator plays the same music over and over again. So the machine provokes the operator and rewards variety in the operator. Another quote, very common quote of Umberto Maturana's that I wanted to mention in relation to language and meta-language is he said, "Everything said is said by an observer to another observer who may be him or herself." And that takes us into the notion of second-order cybernetics and constructivism. First-order cybernetics, which Stuart Umpleby George Washington University. He's a cybernetician. He associates first order cybernetics with engineering cybernetics. I think Heinz called it the science of observed systems. It's the kind of cybernetics that we were doing when we first started doing cybernetics in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. There's a lot of electrical engineering, electronic engineering and stuff. Heinz said, well, what if we apply cybernetic ideas to the cyberneticians that are generating the cybernetic ideas? And that's how second order cybernetics was developed. And so we go from the science of observed systems to the science of observing systems. We see Von Forster's map of the observer and the observer's description of the world and the world, and the world maps back to the observer. These three things arise, they emerge mutually, okay? As opposed to the representationalist or realist model, which has dominated artificial intelligence research ever since the kind of cybernetics, artificial intelligence debates at Dartmouth College years ago, which is the idea that there is a world out there, and it provides me with information, and you know, I receive information from that world. And I create a representation in my head of what that world is, and it more or less corresponds to reality as it really is. The constructivist notion is that model is false. There is something there, but everything that you know about what that something is a result of your interactions with it, and so is constrained by your own structure and what you can bring to those interactions. And through technology, we can amplify our variety and attenuate the variety and such and learn new things, but they're always constrained by our structure. And Ernst von Glasersfeld, one of the biggest proponents of what he calls radical constructivism, hardcore constructivism, observes that objectivity derives from shared agreement about meaning. And similarly, building on the works of Maturana and Varela, or particularly Maturana, Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores wrote a book called Computers and Cognition. And they observed that information is an attribute of an interaction rather than a commodity stored in the computer. And so that's a big difference between the sort of AI and robotics paradigms that have really been dominant over the last 20, 30 years in the cybernetics movement.
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Cool, because I'm almost done. There's just a few little models here that correspond to that. This is Charles Pierce's semiotics model of a subject, a sign, and an object. This is Jürgen Neumann, an Israeli semiotician, wrote a really great book called Processes and Batteries of the Mind, Extending the Limit Mind. I've got a lot of these books at the end of this, by the way, for you to see. He has a theory that that mind emerges as the product of a somatic, semiotic, and social interaction. And when I read that, I found those to be interesting correlations with Von Forster's model there. And that's pretty much it. In conclusion, I want to point out that conclusion is another name for death. Stafford Beer said that a self-organizing system should be always changing without finalizing. Von Forster's ethical imperative, act always so as to increase the number of choices. And it's this ethical imperative that if you wish to see, how to act. And here's some additional resources if you guys are interested in any of this stuff I talked about. As I mentioned, I'm a member of the American Society for Cybernetics, though I'm not a spokesperson for them. They might hate what I've said today. The Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, has a systems man and cybernetics society that does a lot of like nuts and bolts engineering of cybernetics ideas. The Cybernetics Society in the UK and the International Society for the System Sciences. There's three journals, Kybernetes, Cybernetics and Human Knowing, and Constructivist Foundations that deal with a lot of these ideas. And there's a SciComm mailing list that anybody can join. And a lot of the guys that belong to these various organizations are on there, swap ideas. And there's all this stuff is on my website, by the way, this presentation. So you don't need to write all this down, but here's a list of some of the books that I referenced in the presentation. If you want to read them, you can check them out. Earlier.
Thank you.